not giving up today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Activists have been pushing Congress to fix the DACA program. Congress hasn't, but the activists don't see that as a defeat.
Some people might think that we haven't won because we haven't obtained the DREAM Act, but I believe that we have built a movement, and that's our win.
Also, a look at the State Department's global engagement problem.
The deeper issue here is that Rex Tillerson just doesn't really believe in much of what the State Department does.
Plus, we explore the theory that human speech began with Homo erectus.
All their activities show a need for language. With the evidence for organization and planning and culture, erectus would not have had that big a hurdle to get to language.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here on this Monday. March 5th, today was supposed to be a big day for DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It's a day the Trump administration said would be the program's last day when it announced the end of DACA back in September. That announcement also set today as the deadline for Congress to act. They didn't. But two courts have, ruling that DACA recipients would be allowed to renew their status after all. Those rulings effectively took the teeth out of this March 5th deadline. Still, some people who benefit from DACA, so-called dreamers, are seeing today as a symbolic failure to find a lasting fix for them and other undocumented immigrants. And they're calling for action by protesting. Sound there from one of today's protests, this one in Washington, D.C. Reporter Julia Preston was there, and she joins us now. Tell us what you saw today, Julia.
Well, the Dreamers marched up to Capitol Hill, and they spelled out the word unafraid in flowers on the lawn in front of the Capitol building. And then they moved on to Independence Avenue and sat down and had a prolonged sit-in.
How many people were there approximately?
It wasn't a large demonstration. I would say maybe 800 to 1,000 people.
And just in Washington, where else in the country are we seeing these kind of protests?
Well, you saw high school walkouts in Wisconsin and Colorado. There were rallies planned in Dallas and Bakersfield, California, Orlando, Florida. And there were sit-in protests in Little Rock, Arkansas, and in a number of towns in New Jersey where there are Republican lawmakers who have offices.
I know this past weekend you got a behind-the-scenes look at how organizers of this movement were preparing for today. Just tell us about that and what your impressions were of this movement after kind of being inside it.
Well, I think the Dreamers often give you the impression that they are just a bunch of young people who decided to show up for these protests. In fact, this is a very well-organized movement. So I think they're feeling very discouraged and disappointed that Congress didn't take action in January and February, but they're definitely not feeling defeated and they're ready to try and keep this on the front burner as long as they can. One of the people I spoke with was a woman named Karina Ruiz, who came in from Arizona to prepare for the action and did participate in the action today. She has three United States citizen kids. She's a DACA recipient. And she doesn't see the fact that the DREAM Act didn't pass as a loss.
Some people might think that we haven't won because we haven't obtained the DREAM Act, but I believe that we have built a movement, that we have developed more leadership across the states, and that's our win.
So that's Karina Ruiz. And in preparing for some of these demonstrations, I gather that these people had a training session, and I know you went to that. What was that like?
Well, it was quite social, but the young people were also very anxious because a number of them had made a decision to come to Washington to participate in civil disobedience and be arrested. So they were training to do that, to learn the possible consequences if you're a DACA holder of having an arrest, but also what to do and what not to do with the Capitol Police, how not to resist. This is a nonviolent process.
Doesn't getting arrested if you're undocumented put you at risk of deportation?
Many of them say that they feel that the risk of deportation is so much greater that they are not as afraid to risk arrest, to make a protest and bring attention to their situation.
What else is this movement planning, Julia, to keep the pressure up and also intensify it, especially since court rulings have taken some of the pressure off now?
I think they've given up on action in Congress. What they are doing is they decided to turn their attention to the midterm elections in November. So I think you'll be seeing Dreamers turning up at the offices of Republicans who are running for re-election and at the offices of some Democrats who they feel let them down by not voting earlier this year to pass the DREAM Act.
So, Julie, let me take a little sidebar here because DACA and Dreamers were on the minds of a lot of celebrities last night at the Oscars. Let's just listen to Kumail Nanjiani and Lupita Nyong'o here.
Like everyone in this room and everyone watching at home, we are Dreamers. We grew up dreaming of one day working in the movies. Dreams are the foundation of Hollywood, and dreams are the foundation of America.
And so, to all the Dreamers out there, we stand with you.
So, Julia, what reactions have you seen and heard to how large immigration stood out at the Academy Awards? And do people whose futures are really at stake, I mean, they must appreciate the lip service, but do you know how much they're counting on Hollywood to kind of influence their futures?
Well, I think Dreamers are very hard-headed and realistic at this point. They know that their popularity has never been more widespread among the American public. But so far, it hasn't had an impact on Capitol Hill to get Congress to pass permanent protections for them. And so they will continue to mobilize and take advantage of the growing awareness out in the country of their issue. But I think they're really very much focused on getting lawmakers to actually pass the legislation.
Julia Preston speaking with us from Washington. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julia Preston, she's a reporter and a contributing writer at the Marshall Project. There's no debate anymore that Russia carried out an information warfare campaign in 2016 here in the U.S. Its goal was to sow mistrust in U.S. democracy and otherwise meddle with the election. Congress has acted in response to fears of future attacks. It's allocated $120 million to the State Department's Global Engagement Center. That is the agency charged with leading the U.S. government's efforts to counter propaganda and disinformation from abroad. Gardner Harris of the New York Times has been digging in to find out how that effort is going. He's the New York Times correspondent at the State Department. So, Gardner, of that $120 million voted by Congress, how much has been spent so far?
Zero. The administration has spent absolutely nothing on countering Russian propaganda, despite the wishes of Congress and others, including those of the intelligence community. And it's not really clear why. A complete silence from the White House. It is astonishing to a lot of people who, you know, make foreign affairs their life's work.
I mean, Rex Tillerson has indicated he's not sure anything could even be done to stop another social media propaganda campaign in the next election. So is this Global Engagement Center, if it's not spending the money, is it just for show?
So there is a part of the Global Engagement Center that has continued its work, and that's been in their anti-jihadi propaganda. That's why the Global Engagement Center was originally set up. Look, the government isn't so great at this propaganda stuff. The efforts to counter the Islamic State online have been only okay. But increasingly, the government sort of is realizing that what they need to do is hire a lot of people who are already engaged in this battle. You know, Vladimir Putin has gotten rid of hundreds of journalists over the years because they were not towing the Kremlin's line. There's a lot of those journalists who have been exiled or out there are working to kind of talk about what's really happening in Russia, and the United States could help them out. They could, you know, provide some money, funding, a better platform. There's all kinds of things the United States could be doing to sort of up the profile of Putin critics. There are actually things that lots of people talk about should and can be done if only the United States essentially contributed a fraction of the money that really Russia is spending on this problem. You know, we're obviously spending billions on cyber weapons, but you can't really use those cyber weapons in the public space as Russia has been doing on Twitter and on Facebook to sort of what they have done is to augment or distort what are genuine American voices. And that's the effort that you need experts in the language and people working in the open to really kind of counter. And it's just unbelievably puzzling that the Trump administration has refused to do so.
Yeah, and I hear that the Global Engagement Center doesn't even have a Russian speaker on its staff.
Right. Well, they just hired an acting director who actually is a Russian speaker. Okay. He's at the top. But none of the analysts actually speak Russian. They have yet to get around to that. And the bigger, you know, one of the deeper issue here is that Rex Tillerson just doesn't really believe in much of what the State Department does. So he refuses to spend a lot of the money that has been set aside for the State Department and for any number of other efforts. And he refuses to let anybody else in the department make these decisions. The result is that there are something like 1,400 decision memos. These are memos asking the secretary to spend money that Congress has allocated, sitting on his desk undecided. And among those undecided things for many, many months was spending for the GEC.
Yeah, so those people who've left state and those who are still around, how vulnerable do they think the U.S. is to future Russian information campaigns?
Oh, it's not just them. I mean, the intelligence community, and in hearings on Capitol Hill over the last week and a half, the top intel people for the United States government basically said, we're still vulnerable. We could do things, but the president hasn't directed us to do things to counter these efforts, so that, you know, there is widespread agreement that the Russians will meddle in the upcoming 2018 midterm elections. And there is widespread agreement that this government is not at all ready to counter that meddling.
It is remarkable, Gardner. I just did an image search for anti-espionage campaign posters during World War II, you know, the loose lips sink ships kind of thing.
Yep.
Hundreds of them. But now in 2018, no effort being made, you're saying, at that scale to educate the American public about what happened with the 2016 elections or warnings to be careful about what you post, what you repost, how to be good news consumers. There's nothing like that, is there?
Right. And of course, it's not just the United States that's vulnerable. It's worse in Eastern Europe. You know, there's a whole series of elections that are going to happen in Eastern Europe over the next year. The thinking from Congress was that this effort that the State Department would undergo would be to protect not only the United States, but to protect elections around the world. Essentially, the GEC is intended as a defense of democracy around the world, and the negative effects of disinformation and social media and the rest, which is the way most of us now get our news. So this is America supposed to be leading and defending democracy broadly against attacks. And it's just not happening.
Gardner Harris, the State Department correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Just enough time now for a look at something we've got for you on tomorrow's show. We'll be in the U.S. to talk about how global trade affects workers here at home. President Trump's pledge to rewrite NAFTA, the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, has upset leaders in business and politics, but not this Connecticut Democrat.
It really is the best opportunity that we have. We do have an administration that said that they wanted to renegotiate. We need to hold them to that effort.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro represents a part of Connecticut that has lost manufacturing jobs. And when she talks about NAFTA, she echoes some things we've heard from President Trump.
Because, look, I think trade agreements do create jobs. I believe in trade. I've wanted to change the rules of the road as we've moved along. And that's where most of us are coming from. We are not opposed to trade. And though we've been painted as being opposed to trade, that is not the case.
Progressives and organized labor get on board with the president to rethink NAFTA. That's on the show tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Have you ever wondered what a Neanderthal sounded like?
Well, Marco, first, I think you got to wonder if Neanderthals could even talk at all.
I've got Nina Porzucchi in the studio with me. She co-hosts our language podcast, The World in Words. So, yeah, Nina, could Neanderthals talk?
According to evolutionary biologist Philip Lieberman,
It's not going to be as clear, but they could talk.
Lieberman has even theorized how they might have sounded. He even taught an actor for the 1984 flick Iceman.
You found a damn Neanderthal.
That the actor doing this had to practice for months to do this.
you need to practice months to do bah.
Yeah, apparently.
And how did Lieberman know what they really sounded like?
Fun fact, Marco, humans are the only animals that can choke on their own food.
Yeah, well, I'm proof of that last night.
Right. And you know why they can choke on their own food? It's because there's this crucial split in their throats. So there's like two tubes, you know, one leads to the esophagus and the stomach, and the other leads to our larynx, our voice box. Why would we develop this strange architecture?
Yeah, that doesn't make any evolutionary sense.
Right. Except our throats are uniquely designed for language. And language evolved, or that's what Lieberman theorizes. His theory actually is highly debated within linguistics. For many years, the predominant theory in linguistics actually came from the renowned linguist Noam Chomsky. You probably know him or heard
right.
of him.
Yep.
Chomsky theorized that language emerged suddenly in Homo sapiens, not in Neanderthals, and that language is innate within us. Chomsky's theory is called universal grammar. And Ari Daniel from our partner program NOVA reported about a few of these theories, like Lieberman's and Chomsky's, on the origins of language. And one theory took him to Brazil. Here's an excerpt from the podcast.
So we're in the middle of the Amazon rainforest.
This part of Brazil is where Dan Everett and his family have spent years of their life.
There is a rainy season and a rainier season. And it is always humid. The average temperature is in the 90s Fahrenheit. There are a lot of bugs. I've had malaria several times.
But Everett himself has weathered the constant physical struggle of living for months on end in this jungle, all to get to know and learn from a group of people called the Pirahá. It's a community that turned linguistics on its head.
The Pirahá's way of life is still very traditional. They're hunter-gatherers. In some of the villages with the most contact with the outside, you'll find people wearing clothes. In some of the other more isolated villages, you'll still find that the women wear no clothes and the men wear only loincloths. They can't carry on a full-blown conversation in any other language but their own.
Here it is being sung and whistled. Learning the Pirahá language is what kept Everett in the jungle all those years. He's now fluent. There are three vowels. The men use eight consonants, the women seven.
But more intriguingly to me as a linguist, and what has caused the greatest controversy, is the idea and the discovery that they lack recursion in their language.
So to understand why this is such a big deal, you need to know two things. First, obviously, what recursion is. It's the nesting of one kind of phrase inside another of the same type, like yellow, fuzzy, and soft, three adjectives strung together. Or John's brother's house, where the noun phrase brother's house is tucked inside that of John's brother's house. Second, recursion is what Noam Chomsky, again, the godfather of linguistics for decades, asserted to be the fundamental building block for all human languages and a cornerstone of universal grammar. Without it, he and those who subscribe to his theory have said you don't have language. It is, they've said, what makes human beings different from all other species on Earth, now and before. But deep in the Amazon, when Dan Everett listened to Pirahá, he didn't hear recursion.
They don't have words like and or that would normally be used in a language with recursion. So you can't say John and Bill. You wouldn't say John's brother's house. You would say John has a brother, he has a house. So in Pirahá, you would say,
So what's the significance of the fact that languages may differ with or without recursion in terms of understanding the origins of language?
When we find that languages spoken today have grammars far less complex than we would have anticipated, what we find is that having words and putting the words in some agreed-upon order is really all you need to have a language. And with that, you can communicate anything that needs to be communicated.
And recursion isn't necessary to do it. At this point in his argument, Everett considers the grand sweep of human history, not just Homo sapiens or Homo neanderthalensis, but what some believe may have been the ancestor of us both, Homo erectus.
They were the first human beings.
Homo erectus lived from 1.9 million years ago to perhaps 143,000 years ago. They were tall, maybe even taller than we are, and lean, 150 pounds or so. They had ape-like faces.
But still human enough so that we wouldn't have confused them with a gorilla. They would have been the best runners the world had ever seen, able to run to death. Just about any quadruped, if it wasn't dead by the time they caught it, it would have been dead shortly after with one of their stone axes or one of their wooden thrusting spears. Homo erectus carried these tools with them.
They sailed from the African continent to the Asian continent. The list goes on. Erectus had organized villages and burial rites, too. Everything that Everett ticks off, his face glowing as he talks, made Homo erectus pioneers. And his conclusion from all of this.
All their activities show a need for language. With the evidence for organization and planning and travel and culture, erectus would not have had that big a hurdle to get to language.
Especially if language doesn't depend on recursion.
Anything I can say with a recursive sentence, I can say without recursion, and vice versa. Language is simply symbols in agreed-upon order with context.
Now, I should say that Everett's theory is by no means mainstream. Many prominent linguists find fault with it, that it's vague or nonsensical. And I should note that if Homo erectus did have language, and the jury's still out on that, they wouldn't have sounded like us at all. All we have of them is their skeletal remains. But here's Everett's theory.
They had a vocal apparatus that was roughly like a modern gorilla's. So they spoke, we simply speak better than they do because we've had hundreds of thousands of years of evolution for our speech apparatus to catch up with our language.
Yielding a throat that can kill us when a bit of food goes rogue, and that can also utter the phrase Heimlich maneuver.
Reporter Ari Daniel there. You can hear more about the origins of language on this week's episode of The World in Words. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. Nina Porzucchi, thank you.
Abba, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Lalo Alcaraz was a cultural advisor for the Oscar-winning animated movie Coco. One of his suggestions? Don't over-translate dialogue.
Don't say, like, hermano, my brother. It's, like, clunky and it takes you out of it. And if you're a bilingual person, that just ruins a movie. It does for me.
Lalo on Coco. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So much for governing from the center. Italians went to the polls yesterday. The Northern League and the Five Star Movement, two parties on opposite sides of the political spectrum, gained a lot of seats in parliament. The two parties actually have a lot in common. Both have anti-establishment views and deep distrust of the European Union. But there are a lot of questions still about whether they can govern together. Megan Williams is a reporter based in Rome, so this means that Italy now has a hung parliament. Just help us understand what that means, Megan.
Well, what that essentially means is that none of the parties managed to get enough votes. They had to get 40% of the votes to govern. The center-right coalition that had a couple of far-right elements, including the League Party, led by Matteo Salvini, they have about 36-37%, so they did not meet the threshold. The left-wing coalition practically imploded. I mean, it has about 20% of the vote. Now, this was a party that last election was up around 40%. So they've really lost some major backing in Italy. And, you know, as you say, these centrist parties seem to be a thing of the past, at least for now. I mean, it's these populist parties, the League on the extreme right, and the five-star anti-establishment party that have surged up. But neither of them have enough votes to rule either. So we'll see if they strike a deal.
All right, so let's talk about the differences and what they have in common. Just to be clear, the right-wing La Lega, is that the same thing as the Northern League?
That's right. It used to be the Northern League. It was a regional party that was anti-central government in Rome and also anti-Southern Italians. And it went national about 5 years ago. It dropped Northern from its name and became La Lega, or the League. And it started focusing on immigrants and how immigrants were stealing jobs from Italians. It had a lot of racist rhetoric during its election campaign. And that, I think, was part of their success.
So what about the five-star movement? They're left of center. What do they have in common with La Lega, and how are they different from La Lega?
Well, they're a party that's not left of center exactly. I mean, they have corralled a lot of votes from disillusioned people on both sides of the political spectrum. Mm. So studies show that about a third of the five stars are former right-wing supporters, a third are former left-wing supporters, and a third are people actually who've never voted before. So they're appealing to people who are disillusioned, angry with politicians, see politicians as corrupt, are frustrated that the Italian economy hasn't taken off. Some of them are angry over the high level of immigration as well. What they're proposing is essentially to clean up corruption. That has been the drum that they have beaten since their inception. But
how has everything been working out for the five-star party in Rome? Because they won city elections in 2016, and we hear a lot of people are not happy with how that's been going. Why not?
This is the interesting thing about the five-star movement, is that they have a five-star mayor, Virginia Raggi, who was elected a few years ago, and she was going to clean up Rome, clean up the corruption of the city. And to be fair to her, Rome is a difficult city to resolve. It has infrastructure problems. It has debt. But it's been something of a disaster. I mean, she has not been able to do all the things that she said she was going to do. But that does not seem to have affected the popularity of the five-star party, even amongst Romans. You know, I've talked to a lot of people here in Rome who are voting five-star, and people who used to be on the left, used to be on the right, and they don't care. The attitude is that, yeah, okay, this party isn't perfect, but the others are worse.
So you've got the five-star party, kind of, you've got a third in the right and a third on the left and a third they've never really thought about politics before, and then the very right-wing La Lega. What kind of scenarios are we looking at whereby they could form some coalition?
It'll be interesting to see. I don't really know. The Five Star Movement has always said that they would not play ball with other parties, meaning that they won't form coalitions. But, you know, already their leader, Luigi Di Maio, is saying, yes, it's up to us to go into government because we're the party that got the most votes and we're going to govern. And Salvini on the right is saying our coalition got the most votes. Now, the president of Italy, Sergio Mattarella, has the very unfortunate and complicated task of figuring this all out.
So last year, Megan, France and Germany did not fall to the wave of far-right and populist parties, and got a remark that something that did not happen in Italy was a wholesale anti-immigrant tilt to the far right. How much was Europe watching Italy in this election?
I think fairly closely. I mean, both of these parties are not exactly pro-Europe. I would say they're Eurosceptic. They're not necessarily anti-EU. But, you know, it's not great news for the rest of Europe, because these parties, well, I don't think they're going to be doing anything active to get out of the EU. They're not exactly pro-EU. And then the other issue, of course, is migration. I mean, certainly Italy feels like the rest of Europe has abandoned it on the issue of migration. And so it might be a wake-up call for other countries in Europe to say, you know, we really didn't help Italy out that much with all the migrants coming in, and maybe we should have, because it became this huge issue that affected the election.
Reporter Megan Williams in Rome, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
A United Nations aid convoy was finally able to enter Eastern Ghouta today. Eastern Ghouta is the rebel-held suburb of Damascus that has emerged as the latest front in Syria's brutal civil war. Eastern Ghouta has been under siege by their own government for weeks. And even as that UN convoy entered the area today, the regime continued its air and ground offensive. There are reports that trucks left without delivering all of the aid. It's hard to know for sure what exactly is going on in the area, but we're going to hear now about one group of women in Eastern Ghouta, and they're determined to get some information out. My BBC colleague Lena Shekuni has been following what they've been up to. Lena, tell us who these women are.
So these women are doctors, teachers. Some of them are prominent members of opposition local councils. One of them heads the women office there. There are mothers. There are a variety of women that are writing right now.
How did you come across this group of women bloggers in Ghouta to begin with?
So the stories of these women have been shared widely, especially among Syrians, on Facebook in particular. They've become kind of one of the few outlets of how daily life is under continued bombardment and a very tight siege.
Yeah, so what are we learning from these bloggers? What have they been posting?
So there are different voices coming out and different sentiments, but definitely the one united sentiment is defiance and resilience. One woman, Nivin Hotari, she kind of joked around a bit, and you can see a bit of joking and
joking about what?
For instance, she talks about going up 100 flights of stairs to reach internet connection so she can write and share her stories, and then going up and down these staircases with all her energy. And she kind of jokes about it and says, this is like a free gym and a diet that comes naturally. And of course, when she says diet, she's referring to the heavy siege that has left over 350,000 people in the enclave in severe hunger and cases of malnutrition. So it's a type of dark humor, if we may.
Yeah. Well, dark humor gets us through tough times. What about posts that have really struck you as to kind of a great lens into the reality of what they're facing in Eastern Ghouta?
Well, I think one of the posts that really struck me or affected me was by Bayan Rehan. It was one of the first videos I've seen, and in it, she stands very defiant in semi-destroyed space. You can see rubble around her, and she's stood there defiantly saying to Syrians around the world, we do not want to hear messages of hopelessness from you. Mm. We, the people of Ghouta, are standing. We're defiant. We need your support to go into protests and protests in front of the embassies to call for support for us and to stop this catastrophe, basically.
We are aware more than ever that social media can be manipulated for political means, political ends. We know these women are allied with the opposition. So how much of what they're posting would you kind of qualify as propaganda? I mean, should we be skeptical about what they're posting?
I mean, as you said, social media has become the only tool available for people inside to spread their messages. And yes, there have been instances where we could document conflicting reports. But at the end of the day, the people who are there need to get their voices heard in some way or another. Obviously, as you said, they are pro-opposition. The government does not recognize them. Many of these women have been described on state media outlets as being terrorists. But it's the only outlet that we're getting from on the ground that is telling us a story that we don't hear.
There's been anxiously anticipated news, as you know, of a convoy of aid reaching Eastern Ghouta today. Is that likely to make much of a difference to people there?
The current voices we have from on the ground is that people are saying that the amount of aid, the food especially, will not be enough for the people even for one day. There are reports that the government actually took away about 70%, I believe, of the medical aid that came in. And there is anger towards that because people are saying medical aid is what we need right now massively.
Lina Shekuni with our partners at the BBC. Thanks very much for this update on the situation in Eastern Ghouta. Really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
There's been a lot of buzz about the film that won the Best Foreign Language Oscar. It's a Chilean movie called Una Mujer Fantástica, A Fantastic Woman. Here's how the trailer begins.
Mi nombre es Marina Vidal. ¿Tiene algún problema con eso?
The protagonist looks straight at you and says, my name is Marina Vidal. Do you have a problem with that? Marina is a transgender singer, and she has to fight all sorts of discrimination after the death of her lover. Alicia Iñajoque is a trans activist and columnist based in Santiago in Chile. So what's the reaction been in Chile to this film winning Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film?
Well, most people are very happy, and especially the trans community.
Yeah.
For us, it's a story that speak about us. It's our story. I mean, it's not a love story of the daily life of a trans person in Chile and probably in many other places.
So, Alessia, why was this movie important for you personally? And also, why was it important for Chileans to see this movie?
Well, for me personally, a movie that tells most of the things we face every day. For instance, in many parts in the movie, Marina has problems with her name. She's been called a lot of times Danielle in a way to disrespect her.
Right.
And that is something we face in Chile. There is no law here to change our names and our genders in our IDs. And that's something that works against us. Every time someone wants to disrespect us, has in some way the support of the state to make that. It's terrible.
It is trying to be dealt with, the Gender Identity Recognition and Protection Bill, which allows trans people in Chile to change their name and gender without needing judicial approval or gender reassignment surgery. It was introduced, and now it's in the Senate where it's awaiting final approval. How confident are you that this legislation will pass?
The truth, I'm not that confident because we have a new government starting in March. Sebastián Piñera is entering to take the place of Michelle Bachelet, and is a right-wing government, more conservative. And Sebastián Piñera has shown opposition about that bill and about diversity in general. I hope he will change his mind because of how the society is changing, but I'm not sure.
Well, as you say, society is changing. I'm also curious to know how culture, specifically this film, Una Mujer Fantástica, how did it play a role in keeping this bill in the public eye? And has it brought needed support to the bill?
Oh, it has been tremendous. I mean, this movie has generated a lot of empathy for trans people. For many people, we are like a distant story and they cannot relate to us. This movie has changed that. They've seen us more close, more part of a daily life.
I'd also be curious to know what you think it says about Chile today in 2018 that this movie even got produced.
Well, art always is a step ahead, so it doesn't say much about Chile. I mean, if you see the society now, it's kind of divided about the movie. I think most people is happy about the movie, about the success of the Chilean success. But there is a part of the society that says that this movie doesn't deserve the prize. They are quite unhappy about a movie that points them with a finger, showing everybody what we face and why they are making us face. So it's kind of complicated for the dynamics of the society, but it's important. It's making change.
Alessia Iñajoque, speaking with us from Santiago in Chile. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We end today with a look at another big winner from last night's Academy Awards, Coco. The Disney Pixar production got the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. Coco tells the story of Miguel, a boy who loves music, despite what his family says.
No music! No music! No music!
I think we're the only family in Mexico who hates music. And my family's fine with that.
But me?
Be back by lunch, mijo.
Love you, mama.
I am not like the rest of my family.
Miguel's quest eventually leads him to a Day of the Dead reunion with his ancestors. Even before Coco won its Oscar, it had been praised by reviewers for getting a lot of things right with its portrayal of Mexican culture. Cartoonist Lalo Alcaraz might have something to do with that. He worked on Coco as a cultural advisor for Disney. So, Lalo, congratulations are in order.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco. I appreciate it.
So how does it feel to have your work and the rest of the whole Coco team's work rewarded with this Best Animated Feature Oscar?
I was saying knock wood every 5 minutes, just about, and urging people to light Virgen de Guadalupe candles so that we would win, and came through, and also for Best Original Song.
I suspect validation for you personally as cultural advisor for this film, it'll come more from the Mexican community than from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. I am curious, though, to know, what does this Oscar mean to you personally?
What I wanted to happen was to make Coco a really good movie that my kids could watch and their kids could watch, and not a, you know, typical Hollywood whitewashing of Mexican culture, you know, the Hollywood version of culture.
You were initially very vocal in your criticism of this whole Disney project that eventually became Coco. I mean, it'd be easy to just be a Disney critic and stand on the outside. Why did you agree to jump on board as a consultant?
I was never against the project. You know, I'm not against Hollywood using Mexican culture as a backdrop, as part of a plot for a major motion picture. As long as they do it right, as long as they hire people from the community to help with it or to actually do it, we have a long way to go for that. But I was really against the trademarking that Disney's legal department tried to do of the term Dia de los Muertos. And I, like everybody else, you know, fought that. And in one of our rare victories for the community, we won it. And Disney withdrew the trademark application and learned a lesson. And I think it paid off in the attention that Pixar paid in getting all the cultural details right.
In terms of cultural details, what was like one thing that Disney was in danger of getting wrong that you came to the rescue for?
Oh, well, I don't know how much I rescued, but the Pixar crew did an awesome job. They had already done tours of Mexico. And by tours, I mean months and months and in all settings, you know, not just southern Mexico for Day of the Dead festivals or anything, but, you know, to Mexico City, to Guanajuato, to other areas in the south, to Oaxaca, Michoacan. And they really absorbed, spent time with families. You know, they were already on their way to doing a really good job. But, you know, there's a couple of little things I think that, you know, my specialty is what does the U.S. Latino audience, how do they perceive things that Hollywood presents, you know? And so I did my best to try to make sure that there was a lot of Spanish in the movie so that it would flow, you know? And I also always made the note, like, don't translate things, you know? Like, have the characters say things in Spanish and don't say, like, hermano, my brother, you know? Because that's, like, clunky and it takes you out of it. And if you're a bilingual person, that just ruins a movie. You know? It does for me. But one of the funny things was the abuela character was originally supposed to wield a kitchen spoon, a menacing spoon, and that's how she, you know, would like bop everybody and threaten them. And I said, you know, that's cool, and I'm sure that that's happened in some Mexican households, but you have to use the chancla.
What's
you
that?
Know? And the chancla is the dreaded slipper, which is becomes an aerial, you know, missile with amazing accuracy when thrown by an angry mother or grandmother.
Yeah, so Mexican grandmothers are more likely to use a slipper than a spoon.
They pull it off, and it's got like radar on it, you know,
right for your head
around the corner. Yeah, and so you know, and it's a trope. It's on the internet. There, you could find a million chancla memes that Chicanos and Mexican Americans send around to each other, but. And you kind of get tired of it, but I said, you know what? This is for the ages, man. Let's put the chancla in.
Lalo, a lot of people talk about the importance of on-screen representation for Latinos in Hollywood, and it has improved, and Coco is an animated version of inclusion. What's left to do, though, in terms of Latino on-screen representation?
We have to have Latinos writing and presenting the stories and shooting them and also working in the studios and approving them. And, you know, so that if we come with a story about an American Latino family or event or something, it's not foreign. The studios have people reviewing material that understand, you know, that maybe you shouldn't trademark Dia de los Muertos or something like that. I don't know. I just pulled that example out of the air.
For example.
So that's the next step. And us getting to tell our own stories, you know, Coco proved that brown people can open a major motion picture. And Black Panther is proving it again. And that we could be successful around the planet with our real stories. And Wakanda forever.
Wakanda forever. Were you in L.A. last night? Go to any Oscar parties?
Yeah, I was at the Oscars last night up in the nosebleed seats. Me and Marcela Davison-Aviles, who's a lead consultant also with me on the team, we would get up, scream Viva Mexico, and then we went out and had a celebratory cocktail or two.
Nice.
And I have a nice money shot with an actual Oscar, so I'm good.
Not surprised. You know how to roll.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Lalo Alcaraz, cartoonist and cultural advisor for the Oscar-winning animated feature Coco. Thanks very much and congratulations again.
Thank you. Remember me, though I have to travel far. Remember me, each time you hear a sad guitar. Know that I'm with you the only way that I can be until you're.
And that, of course, is Remember Me from the film Coco. It won Best Original Song at the Oscars last night. And don't you forget, we come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.